This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. Here's the extended podcast with pianist Shai Wozner talking more about his recording Impromptu. I'm Julie Elbacher. I hope you enjoy it. You are one of those lucky kids who grew up with classical music playing in your home. What do you remember most about growing up surrounded with this music?
Well, yes and no. There was music in the home, but it actually wasn't being played. I can explain. There was a piano at home, but nobody was playing it. And there were records, specifically an old collection of LPs, and I know I'm dating myself, that was, you know, one of those compilations of, you know, like the great composers type of thing. And, you know, nobody was really using it, but I sort of came across that one day and was very, very intrigued. And luckily, I suppose, it had beautiful liner notes that happened to be in Hebrew. I mean, I wasn't speaking any other language at the time. So I found that absolutely riveting and, you know, started exploring that and got to know quite a few important pieces through that old collection that was just lying there. And of course, the piano too was intriguing and sort of attracted me to start teaching myself how to play it as much as I could. And I guess, you know, when I showed interest, then the lucky part came into the picture, which was, you know, my parents who encouraged it and made it available more and took me to lessons, et cetera, et cetera. But initially, there wasn't really that much classical music. I mean, I grew up in a place where classical music was actually not a significant part of the culture. I'm talking about specifically the town I grew up in, not the country. But luckily, not too far away, there was classical music, you know, in Tel Aviv. There was a lot going on. And so I was able to go to concerts. I was taken to concerts. But in the beginning, it really wasn't quite dominant around. So it took some initiative on my part, I suppose.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Do you remember that old collection you were just referring to? Do you remember any of the pieces that especially struck you at the time?
Oh, absolutely. The Mozart Requiem. You see, there was this combination. Around the same time, Amadeus came out, and my parents took me to see that. And so, obviously, the movie, which is really not for kids when you think about it. I tried to show it to my daughter, you know, a few years ago when she was very little, and I realized, you know, it's not really for kids. But I was so taken with it, and the scenes that have the Requiem in them, you know, just so, you know, they captured me. And at home, I had that piece in that collection, so I could not stop listening to it. And I remember listening to, you know, the Dies Irae and, you know, all those terrifying choral movements late at night. Being absolutely terrified by the music and yet loving every minute of it. You know, so that was really the first major classical music piece that I got to know well. And one thing that I still cherish, even though it's been a while, is the day my parents bought me the score for the Requiem, because I was so intrigued by it. And it's not even like I could really read the score. I had to sort of teach myself how to, you know, where everything belonged and what those weird clefs were. But I remember the feeling of making the connection between those amazing sounds that I heard on that LP and what I saw on the page. And somehow contemplating that those dead notes on the page can become such incredible, incredible music. I think I still find that unbelievably exciting, even though, you know, you would think it would be obvious by now. It's still not obvious. You know, I still, when I see a new piece of music, I'm still excited to see what it would sound like. Even if it's not as great as the Mozart Requiem, it doesn't matter. That connection, the fact that you can actually notate that stuff, and vice versa, that stuff that's on the page, you can revive and make it alive in real time in front of people and get them sort of drawn into what you're doing. That, I think, all comes from that experience with the Mozart Requiem when I was, I don't know, 9 or 10 or something. So that's a very vivid childhood memory that I have.
That's interesting because I was reading an interview with you that you had done earlier, and you described the best part of being a musician, which literally is that sense of making the music. And you touched on it a little bit there, but tell me a little bit more about what that's like to actually bring the music to life and being able to interpret it, both through, of course, the composer's intentions, but you have to bring a little of yourself into that as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's the eternal question. Is there such a thing as not bringing yourself into the music? I mean, of course, you can be more faithful to what the composer notated or less faithful, but even if you are claiming to only play what's written, you're playing it the way you are playing it. And your forte is going to be different from Mr. So-and-so, forte, et cetera, et cetera. You know, your sound, your phrasing, your everything will be different. You know, there's no way of doing it the same way twice. And I do think that, you know, without getting too philosophical here, I do think that music exists in its purest form only when it's played. You know, you can discuss a piece of music when it's not played, of course. You can think about it when it's not played. You can think of a song you like in your head without actually hearing it, but you have it in your head, right? But it's the moment when the sound goes into the air, literally, when the air is literally, you know, vibrating with the music, and it enters somebody's ears, that's when music actually happens. And that's the moment, that's the most important moment that is relevant for us musicians. You know, there's a wonderful term in French, you know, when they say a premiere of a piece, you know, when something is played or performed for the first time, they say création, they say it was created on such and such day. And I think that's actually relevant for every time the piece is played. You're creating it. It will be different on a different piano. It will be different tomorrow if you have something else for breakfast. So many factors play a part. And I think the fact that it's not the same every time is what makes it so exciting, you know, what makes it so relevant and interesting and engaging and what makes it fun.
That's actually one of the things I was curious about with your new recording, Impromptu, because you're improvising around these pieces that were originally intended to be sort of improvisations by the composers. Is your improvisation within that piece the same every time, or is it different?
It is different. And obviously there are, I don't want to say boundaries, but there is a framework, so to speak. There, you know, it's not going to be wildly different every time. And obviously you play the same notes, but the vibe of it and the pace of it and the flow of it can be very different. And sometimes, you know, the fact that it's a recording highlights it even more, because you do, let's say, several takes of something, and one take is just not happening. And you do another take of the same exact thing, and you like it, and it seems to take off for some reason. You can't always pinpoint it even. And you're not doing that much that's different, but somehow the different elements of your playing and the way you lead from one phrase to the other is more inevitable. Things follow each other in a more organic way. And when that happens, everything seems to come together in a more convincing way for the listener. And that can happen with minute changes in the playing. Like I said, some changes that you can't even really put your finger on what it was. You know, I played that faster, therefore it's better. Sometimes it's that, but sometimes it's even more subtle than that. And you just don't know. And yet somehow it's happening, which is why one of the reasons why I love the process of recording so much.
I was thinking, as you were talking about being able to actually create the music and it's there once it's in the air and hits our ears, but I was also thinking how that really emphasizes how important the space between the notes is as well.
Yes. Well, a very great musician named Isaac Stern once said that music is what happens between two notes. And it's certainly true for piano, because piano, you know, is a very mechanical instrument, lots of moving parts. And you can play one note with a pencil You can push the key down and it will play. But it's what you do between the first note and the second note, and on and on and on, that creates the feeling that you're actually saying something and that you're conveying something in the music. That's where music really happens, you know, between two notes. It's very true.
Now, this is interesting to me because many classical musicians with whom I have talked to tell me that the idea of improvising is actually kind of terrifying to them. You know, like they might get with musicians from other genres, maybe jazz or even world music,
right.
And then they're asked to riff a little bit,
yeah.
And it's kind of a scary thought, but you don't seem to be afraid of that. Tell me a little bit more about why improvisation is something that actually gives you a rush.
Well, I was very fortunate to grow up with a teacher who was a composition and theory and sort of everything other than piano teacher. I also had a piano teacher, of course, but this person whose name was Andrei Haidu was of Hungarian descent, who lived in Israel, who was a great composer and a real musical thinker. And I was very lucky to study with him from age 9 to, I think, until I was maybe 19 or something like that. So I really grew up with him. He was a student of Kodály in Budapest and of Messiaen and Mio in Paris. And we improvised all the time. So it wasn't really something that foreign to me. I mean, it was something that was like brushing your teeth. It was, you know, like mental floss, as they say these days. You know, it was refreshing musically, and we used it in many ways. We used it to get to know styles better. So, you know, I would have to improvise in, you know, the style of Mozart, for example, or I would have to improvise connecting different ideas. You know, something would be written down, another thing would be written down. I would have to improvise a transition between them that would be convincing. So I grew up with it, and it therefore doesn't seem so foreign. And to make it clear, this is not jazz. I never actually studied jazz, so this is very different. It's basically free form, open improvisation, but that was used to basically study how music functions. And when you think about it, all of these composers, certainly, you know, Beethoven, Chopin, Liszt, so many of the great composers were famous for being improvisers. It did not used to be such a foreign part of what a classical musician does. On the contrary, it used to be something that was sort of expected. And you can see that a lot of these pieces originate in ideas that they just sort of tried out on the keyboard, either by themselves or in front of people. I mean, it was something that was done to entertain people or to, you know, dazzle people. It wasn't just playing pieces that were fully written out. So I do think that there's something very, very alive in doing that. It's thrilling in ways that are very different from playing a piece that you know is written out and that you may be already familiar with. It's not that that cannot be thrilling. Of course it can, but it's just a different kind of thrill. You know that any minute it can come down crashing and fall flat and not happen. But at the same time, when it takes off, it's amazing because it's like you're riding some little airplane with your ideas, with your thoughts that you're putting together on the spot. I hope that makes sense.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I was thinking, you mentioned your one teacher who started you off until age 19. You also went off to Juilliard and studied with Emmanuel Ax. And I'm curious, what did you learn from Manny that was most memorable?
Well, I learned so many things that I think we'll need a month maybe to.
Well, just give me a few highlights, like things that every day when you sit down at the piano, there's
yes.
something you learn from him that always comes to your mind. How about that? Does that narrow that down a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. I would say that the most important thing is that things sound different to the listener from the way they sound to you when you play. And it can be shocking how different it is. And basically, your entire life as a performing musician, if you really want to narrow it down, is about managing that gap. There needs to be a gap. It cannot be the same, obviously. But you have to know how to manage it. You have to know what you're doing And then you have to listen from the outside to what it sounds like. And then you have to react to what that sounds like in, on the outside to determine how you're going to move forward in the piece. So it's like hearing from multiple angles. I know it might sound weird, but it is absolutely true. And recordings are one way to know what things sound like from the outside. But the real trick is to develop the capability of judging that in real time. Because many things can feel a certain tempo. You know, you think, oh, I'm playing it this fast. And then you hear it back and you think, oh my God, it was so much faster. Or vice versa. You know, you think, oh, this is slow enough. And no, it's just very, very different. And as performers, we have to be in all places at the same time. We have to be right there playing. We have to be as much as possible in the audience judging what we're doing. And we have to be ahead of ourselves as well to know how to connect it with the next idea that in a way that would be convincing. So I think regardless of instrument, this has nothing to do with piano. Even conducting, it's the same thing. Any performing musician, maybe even in the other arts, I think that's the biggest challenge. That's the biggest goal, the most important goal, to the most important thing to master.
It's interesting because as you were describing that, I was imagining those of us who are on the air hosting, especially in classical music, mm-hmm. We deal with the same thing. We think it sounds one way and we'll listen back and do what we call an air check. And it's like, wow, that's not how I thought it sounded at all. That's not what exactly. I thought I said. That's not the pacing. It should go slower. I need to be more intimate here. It applies to so many different things. That's very interesting.
Exactly.
I was thinking about improvising around these pieces, which were written by various composers who, as you mentioned, also were known for improvisation in their day. And I had this picture in my mind that you're sort of like a trapeze artist, but you have a net.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that might be an accurate description? Like, you've got this form that you're working around, so you have that sort of safety net to come back to as you're improvising. Because you were, as I was reading your thoughts about improvisation, you were talking about how there's this rush about, you know, how it's so cool, but then it's also that kind of that feeling like, oh my God, what if it all falls apart?
Yes. And in a way, what happens during an improvisation is essentially like what happens while you're performing a written out piece, except it's stripped down. It's completely naked. You don't have the piece to go back to. You can't rely on what the composer gave you. You have to make it up yourself. But the listening part of it is the same. You listen to what you're doing, and then you try to judge it after the fact while thinking, how am I going to link it to the next idea in a convincing way? So it's not really that different, except it's much, much, much more exposed and more dangerous, if you will. But yes, I do think that you need a framework. You need something to show you the boundaries, to show you, like, you know, what you described as a net. So you would feel like, okay, I should really go this far because then I can do this. You know, if I go all the way now, I won't have anywhere to go later. I need to save some of this. You know, on some level, it's really the same as performing, except you don't have the piece to protect you.
You're considered to be an exceptional Schubert interpreter, and I have to tell you, it is the four Schubert impromptus on this recording that I found most mesmerizing. Without even looking at what the tracks were, I literally would be like, oh my God, that's amazing. And then I'd look down and say, oh, that's Schubert. How do you do that? What is it about Schubert that allows you to bring it to life in such a special way?
Well, thank you, first of all. I don't know. I mean, I think there's something about Schubert that I think touches me in a very special way that has to do with many things. I mean, first of all, the fact that his music combines optimism and pessimism in a very raw way, in a way that's sort of kind of unforgiving, I find very compelling. there's a lot of darkness in it, but I find that aspect very, very compelling. And I also think, you know, that Schubert has something about his music that is, I like to say often that, you know, he sort of tells it like it is. You know, there's a lot of acceptance of things that are not necessarily pretty in the world. And I think one of the things that makes people feel like his music is so particularly touching, and it, you know, that's the most common reaction that you get to his music, by most people. I don't think that comes from the beauty of the melodies, even though they're very beautiful. I think it comes more from the feeling that he's expressing things and letting them happen, you know, without judging them, without trying to change them so much. It's one of the reasons why his pieces tend to be longer and sort of take their time to unfold. And for some people, he may seem repetitive, but to me, it seems like he just lets it happen because it has to be this way. Yeah, I think that's, above everything else, that's what I find in his music so amazing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you did a beautiful job explaining that. His idol was Beethoven, and Beethoven's Fantasy is on this recording as well. How is it different or similar, or were Schubert's impromptus perhaps inspired by Beethoven's Fantasy?
That's a great question. Well, I think that that's a good example of how different they are, because even though it's absolutely true that he was, you know, he worshipped Beethoven, but he could not be more different, I think. And this is a good example. Beethoven's Fantasy is a real improvisation. I mean, you can literally imagine him just improvising that. Because it's so daring and all over the place, and in the beginning, for most of it actually, seems completely arbitrary and you know, to jump from one idea to another almost inexplicably. Or actually not almost, inexplicably. And it starts out of the blue and it just zigzags from one thought to the next. But then at the end, you have a section where everything sort of comes together. And he ends with a set of variations. And the ending could not be more pronounced and clear and emphatic. That's Beethoven. He can be as wild as anybody, obviously, but he needs things to fit together and to sort of to belong together in a perfect way. And Schubert is the opposite. If you take the impromptus, say any of them really, their form is much more conventional than this crazy Beethoven fantasy. All of them have basically, you know, recognizable forms. You know, you can call them many things, but, you know, they're very organized in a way. And yet, at the end of them, you have a feeling that something is left open.
Which other piece would you like to highlight?
How about Chopin?
That actually is what I had down, because I didn't realize like that he did improvisation.
Yes. He was just as famous for that as Liszt was at the time, and often did that, you know, between pieces in the salon. You know, they would play for people small group of people gathered, and he would play his short pieces. And in between those pieces, he would improvise transitions. And you can hear relics of those transitions in pieces that were actually written out. So the one, Opus 36, Impromptu in F-sharp major, starts with a sort of left-hand intro. That must come from something that was just improvised on the spot. It's like the left hand prepares the ground for the piece to begin. So he actually left that in the finished piece.
Well, since we, I think, have one more minute, let's talk about the two improvisations by Charles Ives, which are pretty unusual and were actually transcribed from a 1938 recording.
Yes, these are the closest thing that comes to an actual improvisation, because that's what they were. It appears that he just sat down and improvised in the studio while recording other music, and it was captured on tape and then later transcribed. But this is him actually just sitting down and improvising, so I thought it would be, you know, it would be nice to have an actual improvisation in there by one of the composers.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media with Shai Wozner talking about his new recording, Impromptu. I'm Julie Amacher, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media.